And I also was aware, and have always been aware, that on some deep level, I'm a square, you know. And Willard was fast. People were getting high. And I was very interested in both fitting in and maintaining the integrity of my square self.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past, where we invite an established writer to revisit a piece they wrote in their tender years. That piece may fill them with affection, regret, nostalgia, embarrassment, relief, delight, anguish, all of the above, or something else entirely. Every infant must take those early, brave, awkward steps when learning to walk. We writers must make our own early, brave, awkward efforts as we set out to master our craft. So let's travel back to that ancient time when we were bursting with hubris or scared to death, drunk with language or paralyzed by it, determined to become a writer or terrified that we didn't have the stuff. I'll show them, we thought. But what did we show, really, and to whom? Hey, everybody. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past. I'm Stephen Lovely, director of the Iowa Young Writers Studio.
And I'm Lauren Haldeman, senior editor at the Writing University.
And I'm Danny Colacci, director of the Magid Center for Writing here at the University of Iowa. And listeners, I have to tell you, I am exhausted. My brain is mushy, my eyes are heavy, and all I keep thinking about is when I can finally go to sleep. God. But I cannot sleep now. Because at the time of this recording, we are in the middle of perhaps my favorite time of year, the Big Binge, a week-long class we offer to students here at the University of Iowa in which a gifted and hyper-intelligent writer from LA comes to Iowa City to stream the entirety of a show they've created and written for television. And this week, we've had the extreme pleasure to welcome Gina Welch to campus to binge her amazing FX and Hulu show, Clipped. Today, Gina has graciously agreed to join us on the podcast to talk about how she got from youthful dreaming to the heights of Hollywood. Gina Welch received her MFA in fiction at UVA, wrote the stunning nonfiction book The Land of Believers, and has received many accolades for her TV writing prowess, including an AFI award for Fox's Feud, Bette and Joan, and a WGA award for her work on Castle Rock. She has also worked on FX's Under the Banner of Heaven, Station 11, The Terror, Ray Donovan, and is the creator and showrunner for the critically acclaimed miniseries Clipped, which follows the downfall of former NBA owner Donald Sterling and the Los Angeles Clippers' drive to win a championship under their new coach, Doc Rivers. Adapted from the ESPN podcast The Sterling Tapes, the show, starring Lawrence Fishburne and Ed O'Neill, masterfully blends social justice, fandom, money, power, and humor into an impressive tale that RogerEbert.com says trusts viewers to consider the society-shaping dynamics coursing through this true story. Of Welch's work, writer Vinnie Wilhelm notes that Gina is one of the brightest minds working in the industry today, and we couldn't agree more. We are so happy to have Gina on campus, and we are incredibly lucky to welcome her to our podcast, Sad Me of the Past. Welcome, Gina.
Yes. So happy to be here.
Welcome, Gina. So happy you're here. Yeah.
I sounded insincere, but I am happy to be here.
Are you also tired?
I'm exhausted. Yeah. Yeah.
What a week.
What a week.
Yeah. So much binging.
Yeah.
So much binging.
I know. Well, you know, we'll try not to tire you.
Well, there's
out
no, I'm there. Excited. Yeah,
there's four of us, so if any of us need to dissociate,
if anyone needs to take a nap,
yes, we can pick up the slack.
Yeah. Stephen, you want to tell Gina what this podcast is all about?
I mean, I think she's listened to an episode, and I think she kind of knows. But so, Gina, you know, as you know, we'd love to invite an established writer onto the show and have them read something that they wrote when they were much younger. And I know that today you have a piece that you wrote. I think when you said that it was, well, why don't you tell us about it? Why don't you, if you could sort of set the stage for us, like when did you write this piece? Who were you? Where were you? Mm-hmm. Maybe give us a little bit of context before you read.
Sure. I was in eighth grade and I was new at school. I had gone to a very small private school through seventh grade where I was not liked. And, you know, I was a little bit of a freak. I wasn't a nerd. I just was like, I liked the wrong things. I would eat olives off my fingers. I wore the same color sweatsuit every day.
What?
And so other people at the school were they just more, you were they weren't like that. It was a very...
They seem to have gotten certain memos of I was left off of, you know, especially little girls. There were some sort of codes of femininity that we just didn't have in my household. You know, my parents had split up when I was a baby. My father, you know, was like this leather jacket wearing, you know, menthol cigarette smoking revolutionary communist. He worked at Revolution Books in Berkeley and had sort of some itinerant, you know, apartments he lived in. We spent the weekends with him. And during the week, we were with my mother, who was putting herself through law school. And, you know, once she was through law school, was wearing shoulder pads and Reeboks and taking carpool into San Francisco to, you know, sort of kind of ascend the ladder in the legal world. So I had this sort of bifurcated life. You know, no one taught me how to brush my hair. So I sort of didn't get it. You know, I didn't get what the girls were doing. The girls sort of had horse figurines on their shelves, and I liked all the wrong stuff. And then I got to eighth grade, and no one knew who I'd been.
Ooh. So was it a school change? Did you go to...
It was a school change, yeah, and it was in preparation for... because I was going to go to a Berkeley High School, which is a big public school. And so I transferred to Willard Junior High School, which is a feeder school for Berkeley High. And Willard was, you know, a big public junior high. And I also, you know, 2 years before I transferred to Willard, my father died. And so there was just like a kind of a tectonic shift in my life. And what I liked about Willard was that I could be a whole new person, you know.
Yeah.
And I had a mullet when I was a little girl, you know. It was like, and I don't remember consciously wanting one, but for some reason my hair never grew in the front, but it grew in the back, or that's how I remembered it anyway.
Ahead of your time.
I actually can share a picture of my mullet.
Please.
And I got a good haircut, like right before I started Willard. So when I arrived, people thought I was regular, you know?
It's a good trick.
And this was very exciting to me. And I really wanted to cultivate my regularness by forcing people to be friends. And I didn't really know how to do that. And so part of what I was doing in study hall was that I would write these serialized stories and then perform them for the kids who were sitting at my table.
Oh, my God.
Wow. So that's the context in which these stories came about, yeah.
When you transferred schools and you talked about sort of this experience you had when you were younger, where you weren't fitting in, the olives on the fingers and the haircut, when you showed up at Willard, could you tell that people were either looking at you differently or responding to you differently? Like, was it something that was palpable in some way?
Yeah. I mean, I had been in school with people who had known me through all my freak years. Right. And so I mean, I had like crushes, you know, when I was a kid. They were not reciprocated. When I got to Willard I guess I was a young teenager. I started there when I was 12 and turned 13 my first year. Boys liked me.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, my God, right on. They don't know.
They don't know what they're getting into.
They don't know it's under the haircut.
They never know, too.
Yeah, they didn't know.
And how conscious were you of reinventing yourself or altering yourself? Like, do you think, looking back, do you just think that's what you did, or were you aware at the time that you were kind of going to try to be this kind of different person?
I wasn't aware. I mean, to a certain extent, I have an older sister. She was very cool. And I would go into her room and steal her clothes and wear them to eighth grade. And so I was aware that I was sort of wearing her persona.
Cosplay.
In a way. I was cosplaying my cool older sister. And I also was aware and have always been aware that on some deep level, I'm a square, you know. And Willard was fast. It was fast, you know. People were getting high. People were having sex. And I was still kind of a kid. But I was very interested in both fitting in and maintaining the integrity of my square self. Hmm. Yeah.
Did you get tips on how to become this cool self from 17 magazine?
You know, I think Jane was the thing at the time. Jane was my sister's jam, and so it was mine.
Nice.
Yeah, it was Jane. At 17, always, I mean, again, I always felt a little outside of the codes of femininity. And this was the 90s. And so the kind of femininity that dominated my childhood, you know, in the 80s was like, whoa, this has nothing to do with me.
Right.
You know, the sort of like voluminous – I mean, I had voluminous hair, but it was the wrong kind of voluminous. You know, all of the kind of Christy Brinkley Barbie shit. I just – it wasn't what I was about. And then the 90s had a slight – I mean, the grunge aesthetic was sort of –
Thank
Coming
God.
Up. Yeah. And in Berkeley, there was a real sort of hip hop aesthetic. And so I felt like that gave me a sort of path forward.
My mom insisted that I couldn't read 17 until I was 17. So it was a banned book, but I found a way. And I remember distinctly going through that or Jane and looking for tips on how to kiss boys. Mm. And then also how to use lemon juice to bleach your hair in the sun without your parents knowing.
Hmm. Did you guys have sun in?
I was not allowed to get sun in. I'm telling you.
Yeah, I didn't use it.
I was on lockdown. So, but when I heard about the lemon juice, I was like, shoot, there's lemons around.
I know where to find those.
Yeah.
So, Gina, I'm curious about, like, you talked about coming into this new school and you're, like we've been saying, you're sort of like understanding this new relationship with the sort of social elements of what that school has. And then you mentioned that one of the things you did to sort of like be cool and entertain folks was read these pieces that you had written. Were you writing before going to Willard? Is this something you always did? And how did you come to this point where you realized the writing is something I can do to entertain others?
Well, I in seventh grade, I had a teacher named Mr. Gould who respected me, which was crazy, 'cause I wasn't like a standout student. He was my English teacher, and I liked the way that he responded to my writing. Hmm. You know, I don't know. I mean, maybe he did that for all the kids. Mm-hmm. But he really took me seriously as a writer. And so I found when I was sort of looking through my old stuff, this story I'd written for his class about going to look for a UFO. And the primary thing I remember about that class is that it wasn't that I enjoyed the writing process. I enjoyed how I felt when Mr. Gould was delighted by my writing,
What were you reading? Like, were you a reader when you were a kid? Did you watch a lot of TV? Like, what was feeding sort of this writing? Or were you just doing it sort of, you know, out of just sort of thin air?
No, I was a big reader. I mean, okay. I think when I was very young, it was a lot of Roald Dahl. I liked Judy Blume. You know, as I was getting older, I mean, I'm trying to think what was sort of shaping me around that time. I mean, like, don't get me wrong, I watched a ton of TV.
Okay.
And, like, and I watched TV in that way where it's different than now where it's like you can click over to exactly what you want. I mean, at the time, there's a show that I would want to watch, and so then I would watch the four shows before and after
that. Oh, yeah.
You know, because even though I'm like, I hate this, but I'm going to watch it so I can get to the one I want.
Right.
So I watched a ton of TV. I mean, I think the formative show for me was definitely Twin Peaks, which I watched when I was 12.
Oh, okay. Man. 12 is...
Is that early for Twin Peaks?
I feel like I still can't watch Twin Peaks.
I've never seen it. I don't
Teenage
know.
Prostitution and incest, which and murder. But I didn't really get the incest part until I was an adult. Yeah.
Were you, when you were watching television or watching Twin Peaks, were you thinking about it? I mean, this may have been way too early, but were you thinking about it in terms of like art and narrative and paying attention to sort of how it was put together? Or was it just you were just kind of taking it in?
How can I describe my obsession with it? It was an obsession. Yeah. And so I didn't understand that it was something that people had made. Here's one thing that will indicate my obsession with it. Julie Cruise did a lot of the music for Twin Peaks, and there's a song that she did called Falling. Now, I'm tone deaf. I can't sing at all. And I was playing the piano, but I wasn't very good. But I really wanted to share my love of Twin Peaks with, this is before I transferred schools, with the kids who didn't understand me. And so I learned how to play Falling, and I brought it into music class at school, and I asked for a special time that I could play it for
okay. Yeah, I know.
Brave.
I'm so proud of you, and I'm so heartbroken for what was going to happen.
Yeah, it was not a hit. Yeah.
But I'm proud of you.
And I tried to sing also in a very high Julie Cruise register.
Nice, nice. Oh, yeah. Amazing.
I learned the X-Files theme song on our electric keyboard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was it.
Did you go,
The keyboard did that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Who did you
play it for?
Myself.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't
share it. Oh, no. I did not have the courage that you had, or the chutzpah.
So I have another question. I know I'm dominating here, but so how did you know when you got to this school, how did you decide that writing these pieces and reading them for your friends in study hall would be something that would be like socially advantageous? Did you kind of find some people first and then realize like, oh, I think they'll appreciate this? Or did you just kind of go in cold to some people that you didn't really know very well and just start doing it? Like how did that? If you can remember.
I can't remember inception point. Okay. I mean, I remember this was happening. I don't have the dates on any of these, but I remember this was happening fairly early on. Okay. And they kind of petered out. You know, I stopped doing it once people started hanging out with me.
Yeah.
That's when you drop
by the way, they weren't hanging out with me because of these.
I mean, that's whatever reason, I'm sure is good. Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I do remember the sensation of liking being at a table with other people and writing these and then reading them to them before study hall was over. Now, I don't even fucking remember what study hall was. Yeah. I mean, what is that? It's just like a period where no one has to deal with you.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. That's exactly what it is.
You're in a room.
You're supposed to study, but, you know.
Well, obviously, I wasn't doing that.
No, this was more productive, probably, yeah.
When you were writing these, you know, you talked about, you know, sort of your mom was very busy, but you also had a sister that you were really connected to and it seems like was really formative for you. Do you remember, aside from Mr. Gould and these students and your peers, do you remember anyone else seeing your writing at the time? Like, were you sharing this with your sister or your parents or anybody else?
No, yeah. Definitely not. No, I mean, I was always aware of my sister as much smarter and more sophisticated than I was. And I was certainly looking to her as a model. But I didn't want her to see the shit I was doing because it wasn't that good. You know, I knew it wasn't good. No, I wasn't really sharing it. I wasn't really sharing it with anyone else. I mean, I was very, very, very insecure. You know, and very, self-conscious. So, yeah.
Sounds familiar from eighth grade.
Well, yeah. We're all looking at each other
and,
like...
And ninth and tenth and 11th up. And early 20s.
And yesterday.
And yesterday.
Yeah. And today.
I mean, it may be... You can cut this if it's not, like, it doesn't end up being applicable to what we're talking about. But I don't know if you have had anyone on here who's talked about getting their period around the time that they...
Oh, yeah. Not yet, but let's do it. Yeah. Let's go directly in there.
Well, just to sort of give you a portrait of the psyche of someone at that stage in life in the early 90s, I think things have probably improved for many young girls.
Right.
But when I got my period, I was in eighth grade, didn't want to tell anyone, didn't want to tell my mother. And what I would do is I would put on a disguise. So I had a Sacramento Kings flat bill baseball cap.
Love it.
Never had watched hockey. Mm-hmm. And I would put on like an oversized sweatshirt. And I would go to this little pharmacy up the block. And I would walk around the aisles until all the customers had left. And I would find my window to like get some pads, check out as quickly as possible. and book it out of there. But I didn't, I couldn't go to the counter until there were no customers in the store. And so they thought I was trying to steal. You know, because it was like, oh, this kid who's in a disguise.
Creeping around.
This is a burden.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So I was very, very self-conscious about the purchase of pads. Mm-hmm. And then what I would do, I didn't want my mother and my sister to know that I had my period. And so during my period, I would stash used pads. And I also had, Dave Kajanik talked about his plastic bag of Gap from the Gap. Yeah. I had mine in my closet that had used maxi pads in it until the end of my period, and then I would go find some public trash can where I would dispose of them.
Get rid of the evidence.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it is better now, but it's still...
Oh, my God, yeah.
You know, what needs to happen is just we need to keep talking about... I got my period in ninth grade, right before a soccer game, on a lunar eclipse.
Wow.
And guys, now... Every time there's a lunar eclipse, I get my period. It's like scheduled. Yeah. Isn't that wild?
They do call it the moon cycle.
I mean, I've been tracking it for a while, so.
And were you aware, did you feel like you were being touched by the moon?
I was aware of being like way behind. Everyone else had gotten the period, and so I was thrilled.
You were thrilled when you got it?
Yeah, I was like, finally, God. Yeah.
Having to be, like, discreet about the fact that you hadn't had it?
Because I didn't fully understand. I didn't understand sex. I thought that you both had to know how to do the splits and that you would sit on the floor and inch up to each other while doing the splits. I thought, and then make sex.
Mm-hmm. That's not how we're supposed to do it?
Oops. Danny, you don't have to know how to do the splits.
I you know, something that I think about a lot, and it will bring back, I think, hopefully to what you will be reading soon, is just the ability to get information now.
Yes.
You know, I think about whether you're a young queer individual, whether you're a young woman who's just gotten their period, whether you're a guy trying to figure out, I don't know, anything in the world. It doesn't matter what your gender or your background is. You can go on the internet and go on YouTube or Reddit, and you can find answers and information. Now, again, this isn't speaking about disinformation and fake news, but like you can find somebody else who's going through it, and this younger generation is so open. And so I just think about how, you know, what it would have been like to have that young you who was feeling like, man, I can't even tell anybody I'm going through this. I'm going to stash the pads in my closet. If there was the access of like going on YouTube and hearing someone else talk about their experience and seeing it and sort of making that community beyond. And I think about that a lot for writers. And when I was younger, I didn't know anybody else who was writing. You know, I had a great teacher when I was really young that sort of said I did something well, which to me was intoxicating.
Yes.
I sort of thought, oh, someone is finally saying I did something right.
Yeah.
But I didn't have anyone to talk to about it. And I'm not suggesting that being a poet is the same as getting your period, but there was like an embarrassment about it. Like I sort of was like, oh, I can't tell anybody that I'm interested in this thing. Mm-hmm. And I just look at the young people now, and I mean, you can create your whole own message board with people from across the world sharing their work. Right. So it's just really interesting to me to think about how many of the things we all experienced maybe is different now because of the way technology.
Mm-hmm. Because they're very isolating. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at your piece that you brought in. It's on graph paper. Mm-hmm. It's written with pencil. The handwriting is very bubbly, but also at times italic.
And maybe there's a drawing at the top.
Yeah, so, and I also would like to note that my exclamation points, you know, the top half of the exclamation point is a triangle.
Well, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
Is the bottom a heart?
No, never.
Is it weird that I used to do that?
Yeah. Danny, we'll talk about it. We'll go over it in post.
Okay, yeah. Great.
Yeah, well, I think maybe it's time to, would you be willing to read it?
Sure.
Oh, cool.
So this is a series called Mavis and Fluffum. It's about the adventures of two cats who are a gay couple.
Yeah.
Mavis was, as you can see in this picture, was a fluffy white cat who wore a business suit, kind of a square. And Fluffums, as you can see down here, wore sunglasses, smoked cigarettes, and wore a leather jacket.
Fluffums kind of a short king, like just a little.
And I look, because this is sad me, I think we got to point something out. So you're saying one of them was like maybe wearing sort of a shoulder pads pantsuit, and the other one was wearing a leather jacket, smoking cigarettes.
Right.
I wonder who that reminds us of after this episode.
That's your mom and dad.
Oh, nailed it.
Well, what's funny about this is I didn't know that's what I was doing until you emailed me and asked me to come on Sad Me of the Past.
That's what we're doing.
And I pulled
here.
These things out. I haven't looked at them since 1992. And I was like, oh, shit, that's my mom and dad. And I talk about it.
Yeah,
anyway,
I think that's a very, I have a story like that too.
Here we go. This is edition three.
Edition three.
The title of this episode is Mavis Meets JJ. Mavis and Fluffums were relaxing in the sun one afternoon when the guy from the pound drove by in a truck. They tried to run, but the pound guy was just too fast for them. He caught them and put them in the truck going to the pound. Fluffums and Mavis hid in the corner of the truck, too frightened to move. A group of big huskies surrounded them, growling and foaming. Oh, geez, said Fluffums. What now? First Armageddon, now this.
First Armageddon? What?
I have explained
what... Was that episode two? Okay, awesome. No, don't explain. That's what we just need to know.
I thought getting picked up by the...
It is a type of emotional Armageddon.
Yeah. Okay. First Armageddon, now this.
First Armageddon, now this. What do we do, Mavis? We can die fighting, or, said M-Bone, we can die without honor. Quick and easy. Well, said Fluffums, neither way sounds especially pleasing. Are you sure there is no other way out of this? Maybe, said Mavis. And just as the dogs were ready to pounce, the doors opened and the cats were removed. Thank the Lord, cried Mavis. But then they were placed in two cramped boxes with cage screens for doors. Right across from them were the rabbits. Mavis and Fluffums were forced to stare at rabbits all day long. Boy, oh boy, said Fluffums. I'd do anything to be in a room alone with those rabbits. Me too, said Mavis. Just then, a young woman of 8 years walked in looking for two cats to call her own. Her name was Jenny Jones.
Yes. Jenny was the best.
It was the 80s name. Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know if you're going to think Jenny Jones is very cool.
Well, yeah. Let's hear about it.
Her name was Jenny Jones, but everybody called her JJ. Anyway, underlined.
Enough with the character.
Moving that narrative forward. Come on.
God.
Already. Let's have the story already.
Okay.
JJ immediately rushed over to Fluffums and Mavis's cages and began sticking her fingers through the little holes and poking them. Fluffums and Mavis were quite disturbed. She squealed with delight. Ooh, she said, they're so sweet. Mummy, I want these ones. These are the best. Mummy agreed. Mummy in quotes. And so Fluffums and Mavis were bought by Jenny Jones and taken to their little suburban home. There, JJ took them to her room and threw them on the bed.
Oh, interesting.
It's rough.
Okay, she said, you, pointing to Mavis, are Michelle. Mavis was disgusted. Michelle? I'm a man, he thought. And you, pointing to Fluffums, and Fluffums, hoping for a better name, are Fluffy, Fluffums moaned. Then JJ proceeded in throwing a tea party and dressing Michelle and Fluffy up in pink doll dresses. Jesus Christ, this is a nightmare, Mavis whispered to Fluffums. Cookies were shoved down their throats and clip-ons slammed on their ears. Later that evening, Fluffums and Mavis ran away. You'll always be Mavis to me, said Fluffums. And you'll always be Fluffums to me, said Mavis. And they walked into the sunset hand in hand.
Oh my God.
This is beautiful. Wow.
That was amazing.
Wow. I know.
Okay, there's so much we have to get into.
Most of which involves how clearly they're your parents, but we'll get to that.
Well,
later.
I think we covered that, right? One, they're your parents. Check.
I don't know, though. There's maybe there's a little sister in there somewhere. I'm not sure.
I don't know. They walk.
Yeah, I don't know.
The JJ brings them home, basically like reunites the family, and then they walk off into the sunset together.
I wonder when I write, when I remember writing stories at 8, there was like one particular scene I wanted to get to, and then I'd write the story like around it. Mm. And for this story, I feel like, was it throwing them on the bed?
I don't remember having a plan for these stories.
Okay.
I mean, they were more or less free write.
Okay.
Yeah, they were free write.
They were free write. Mm-hmm. So you didn't know what was going to happen.
Mm-mm.
Oh,
no.
Man.
No, because it was, I mean, I was trying to get through them so that I could read them to the other kids.
Oh, yeah, just.
So was there, I mean, was there a group of other kids? Was it kind of the same kids every time you would write and read, or was it different kids? Or
I don't have a memory of it.
Okay.
I don't have a memory of who they were. I just remember my intense desire to force them to listen to me.
What did they think? What did they think of episode 3?
I think I mean, I read these now knowing what was going on in eighth grade, and I am aware of how juvenile they feel, and that I'm putting in the Jesus Christ and the smoking cigarettes on top of stories feel like they were written by a little girl. And so I remember kids listening and being entertained, but looking at them now, I realize I wasn't doing the thing that the other kids were doing, which was effectively convincing their peers of their maturity.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
I would have been impressed, though, that you wrote Jesus Christ, because when you read it out loud, I felt like, oh, no, can we say that on this podcast? We were not allowed to cuss or anything. I would have been like, whoa, this girl. It's like, it's cool, too, that it's a serial that you're, series of episodes, like, how did you know to do that?
I'm trying to remember. I mean, it's funny. Whenever anyone asks me for my favorite book or the favorite book I've read in the last year, I'm like, have I read anything? Yeah. You know, I just have – things go in one ear and out the other. And so I can't really remember what I was reading at the time, but I do remember that I was reading books that were sort of connected.
Right.
So I think I must have known that way. But also, look, they're television episodes.
Right, you know? Exactly.
And I was watching a lot of TV.
Yeah. So. And this has like a television arc.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask. Like when you read this now, excuse me, and you're looking at just the way that the piece is unfolding, are there parts of it that you are like impressed with that you were doing in eighth grade?
I liked my verbs. I mean, I looked at this and I'm like, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some passive voice construction. But, man, it's like, you know, I've got some interesting verbs that create images. And was I aware at the time that I was sort of like nibbling around the edges of something that felt sort of transgressive when it came to gender? I was trying to figure out gender, I think. I think I was, you know, I think I was sort of like, this stuff is confusing and seems all made up. And what is our place in any of it? I mean, obviously, Jenny Jones was my stereotype of a little girl who felt foreign to me, you know, who was doing tea parties and had hair clips and wanted to treat animals like babies. And, you know, these were sort of images of little girls that I felt like had nothing to do with me. And so it was important for me to put her on the page to prove that I was separate from her and maybe better than her. But also because I felt she was the winner and I was the loser, you know.
But you also got to inhabit her for a little bit. Right.
Well, I think it's very clear to me now. I was very much writing Jenny Jones from the outside.
Oh, okay.
You know? I mean, it's like we're talking about in the Big Binge. It's like you cannot condescend to your characters. Yeah. You have to write everybody from the inside. And I just didn't, you know, I felt so like oppressed by that stuff that I couldn't have any compassion for it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you can know that early, that's something that you sort of need to do. That's a pretty sophisticated, artistic sort of revelation that you need you know, go through people to the from the inside. Yeah. I mean, the amazing thing to me is that she's there. She's there, and you sort of make an effort to sort of engage with that person and have these two sort of animals have an experience with her that is difficult and a little weird and traumatic, and that they managed to survive. Mm. I thought that was really interesting. I thought the dialogue was really amazing too. Like, it's clear that you like writing dialogue, and that you're really already very gifted at writing sort of dialogue that has some energy to it and that is engaging and funny. Like, I thought that was something I really noticed. Yeah.
I was interested in the way you use sort of rising action and inciting incidents.
Yeah.
I mean, there's multiple moments. We've been talking about this also in the Big Binge about like characters having a desire and sort of what they're willing to do to get it. And also putting them in conflict. And so immediately you have these two cats that are picked up by the pound, and there's the threat of what's going to happen to them.
I love the dogs.
And so the dogs come at them.
And then there's a deus ex machina.
Yeah.
Doors open, they're out. Yeah.
And so they're saved, right? And it's just as the dogs are surrounding them.
The
oh, but they're not saved.
But they're not saved. Yeah. And then they get into this other cage, and then they're looking at rabbits, and there's like this desire to get out and chase the rabbits, but then they're being poked by this young woman who then seems like, okay, now they're going to get saved again. But then the minute she's saved,
thrown on the bed,
it's that great turn. It's like she throws them on the bed and she says, now you have a different name and I'm going to put clips on your ears, and they have to escape again. And I just think that motion for an eighth grade writer.
Yeah.
We say this all the time on the show. I just did not have that capacity to think in an arc like that when I was at that age.
Or is it like an instinct or whatever? I mean,
yeah.
Like, because, yeah, there is that pattern of sort of like capture, escape.
Yeah.
And it's very suspenseful. And then there's a release and then it's suspenseful again. Where does that come from? Maybe television. I mean.
You've been talking about in TV is not the beats, but like the, what are they called? The way the breaks are.
Story break, yeah.
And so it's almost like there's like a break for commercial, like at each section.
Little cliffhangers.
She was already planning to monetize.
It's just really, really fascinating to see that already as an eighth grader, mm-hmm. that you were kind of being able to get that across.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think I'm sure a lot of it came from my TV consumption, but I also, you know, for the first time, I had other kids looking at me and listening to me. And I felt this kind of intuitive sense that I had to keep showing them something new in order to keep their attention.
Mm. You know? Buy their love.
Right. And so there's something in that is a natural story break. It's like, okay, this happens. Well, don't stop listening now.
Yeah, yeah.
Something new is coming along.
Come to study hall next week.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So how did your writing sort of develop after this? Like, as you were in junior high school, into high school, were you continuing to write? Like, what were those years like in terms of the development of your writing or thinking or interest in television narrative?
Yeah. Well, I'll just say before I get to that, I mean, and one of the things that I have really loved about this podcast is that you sort of realize what is latent in here thematically that ends up kind of reappearing in your later work. For me, it's I was trying to make sense of the idea that my parents had ever been together.
Oh,
you know,
whoa.
Because I didn't have any memory of them together,
right.
And they're so unlike one another. And I think I have always felt that sort of duality in myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I am a square and I'm cool. I have certain feminine trappings that people can see, and yet inside I don't feel that femininity. You know, like I have always felt a split. And so I look at this now, and that's always been threaded through my work and has come up in many of the things I've done as somebody who's struggling with a feeling of hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. You know, I say I'm X, but I'm actually Y. Mm-hmm. And so I wish that I had stayed at this because to me, I was already on to something very interesting that is like completely organic to the polarized place that I came from, yeah. you know. But what I ended up doing when I was in high school was, you know, a lot of Dear Diary relationships, friendships, loneliness, I'm not understood stuff.
But I bet that thread carried through those too. It'd be interesting to find those as well and see what you were working with subconsciously.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
No, I'm really glad you slowed us down there because, yeah, that's so interesting. So do you think if you had continued to kind of pursue this that you would have understood what you were doing? Like that at some point you would have realized what you were writing about and that would have been revelatory or useful to you? Or do you think it might have just continued, you're sort of working it out and then you move on? Like, because it sounds like you didn't really realize what you're writing about until much later.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'm almost 45, so like kind of around now.
I mean,
interesting, yeah. You know, well, what I came to realize, you know, I when I was in high school, I wrote stuff for our class called Social Living, you know, which was basically a sex ed class. And we had a teacher named Nancy Rubin who would, you know, write in the margins of your – she'd read your journals and she'd write things in the margins. Like I wrote at one point in my journal, you know, when I grow up, I don't want to be married or have children because I don't want to be tied down. No, I have a child now. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. But, like, you know, she wrote in the margins, I can relate. And I'm like, no, I don't know if that's appropriate.
So you're writing a journal in sex ed class?
Yeah. That. And then she actually ended up publishing a book using a lot of the selections from her students' journals.
Wow.
Yeah. Did you sign any release forms? What's going on?
I didn't. I think my sister has something in her book.
Wow.
Anyway, so that period, my teenage years, I felt very encouraged to write about myself. Mm. And I think to me, and then when, you know, I can sort of go through what I was doing in college and graduate school. But I think to me, what I so have kind of compassion and admiration for in terms of what I was doing in eighth grade was I was writing outside of myself and my own existential questions were being funneled through the work. And that's kind of where I'm at now. You know, right. I don't want to write myself. I want to sort of explore my questions about the world through other characters. You know, it took me a long time to come back to that.
Of course.
Yeah.
So Gina, when you're writing this in eighth grade, and obviously now here you are, you're at the University of Iowa, you're teaching this class about a show that you wrote. How did you go from writing this amazing story about two cats to deciding that writing was something you wanted to pursue for a living?
Well, I had a similar experience to the one you described when I was in college. I certainly did, what I was told I was good at when I was in high school was math and science. It was just enjoyable to me. I like puzzles. You know, I really like puzzles. I could do calculus. I mean, once we started getting into the spatial stuff, my brain broke down, but you know, I really, really liked that stuff. And I had a great chemistry teacher who felt really strongly that it was part of her role to convince more women to enter STEM fields. I mean, they didn't call it that at the time, but it was important to her. And then I got to college and I got one bad grade in chemistry and I was like, I guess I'm not good at that anymore. Done. And then I was just drifting. I wasn't writing. I mean, I was very intimidated by the students in the English department because I had gone to, you know, a big, shitty public school where the pedagogical method was, you know, you talk about King Lear by saying, well, in my family. Yeah. So I didn't actually know how to analyze a text. And I was in school with a lot of kids who'd gone to prep school and really knew how to talk about literature, and I felt dumb around them. So I was scared to go to English classes.
Just to interrupt real quick, sorry. Where were you? So you grew up in California. Yeah. Where were you in college? Were you still in California?
Yale.
I've heard of it.
Good old Yale.
I was at Yale. I was smart.
Yeah, talk about intimidating. Yes.
Yeah. So.
Well, but also a different. I mean, I also think about this with college. You know, folks who decide to go to school often end up sometimes far away from home, and so it's not only are you going to a place where, in your case, sort of intellectually, you were trying to find yourself, but I imagine similar to what was happening in eighth grade. You're trying to find yourself amongst these people who had different upbringings, different backgrounds than you, et cetera. So it seems like a lot of that stuff was in the air and happening at the same time.
And like present and curate yourself again the same way you did in eighth grade, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I know this is really common with kids that age, but I really just felt like I didn't have a niche. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I didn't have, it, you know, and I don't know now if it was the wrong school for me. I just really got lost there. And there were kids who threw themselves headlong into a cappella groups, you know, improv. You know, Vinny and I had very similar experiences at Yale, which is that we were really lost. Mm-hmm. We were both really lost. Mm-hmm. And then my senior year in college, I don't know what made me want to write. I think I was dating a guy who was taking writing classes. I took a comedy writing class that I kind of enjoyed and that I was like, oh, this is a pleasurable thing because it was I could entertain people. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I want to skip all the prereqs. I'm a senior. You know, let's see if I can get into an advanced fiction writing course, even though I've done none of the fucking like groundwork to put myself in this class. And I had there was a professor, a writer named Robert Stone, who was like one of the Merry Pranksters. And he let me into the class.
Wow.
And he, again, treated me with respect. And he had me, you know, I was the first student he had talk about a short story we'd read a short story by Anne Beattie called The Bowl. And I read it and it, you know, it had metaphors. I had no idea what to say about it. And I came into class and I summarized the story and I was like, and I don't know what it means. I mean, I said it in a much, much more insecure way than that, but I was like, I have no idea what this story is about. And he didn't diss me, and he dissed a lot of kids in the class, but he didn't diss me. He was like, she is the bowl.
And I was like, I spent a lot of time wondering what the bowl
that's
was.
The t-shirt. Yeah, she is the bowl.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I mean, he really destroyed the confidence of a lot of kids in the class. And I think what made them vulnerable to that destruction was that they they were self-assured. Mm-hmm. And I think he could tell that I was not.
Yeah.
And, you know, he took me into his office at the end of the semester and he said, you should really do this.
Wow.
And that was, you know,
that's huge.
Like, it's so sick that I think of it this way, but I think of it as like the kiss of death. Because he's the first person when I was in college that told me I could do anything, you know? And so I was just like, okay, I don't even know if I'm good at it or if I like it or if it's right for me. But like this dude whose writing I revered and whose intellect I revered, you know, I was like, all right, if he thinks I should do it, I guess I should do it.
Well, it's like Mr. Gould. Yep. Right, it's like when you do something and someone recognizes it, especially if it's a talent and if it's something it sounds like you enjoyed, to just hear somebody say, "I see you and I see this and you should continue." It's not only affirming, but it's as clearly happened to you. It's life changing.
Yeah.
Do you think if he hadn't said that you would have continued to write in some way? Like, so in a way, like I sometimes feel. I know what you mean by that, by someone suggesting you do something that maybe you're not sure you want to do. But I guess I feel like in that situation, maybe he really couldn't know exactly what you should be doing. He was just sort of, he knew that you ought to maybe go in a certain direction. I mean, I don't know.
Well, yeah,
maybe.
And I think the reason I took it seriously is because I saw how harsh he was with some of the other students.
Yeah.
And also, you know, this was toward the end of his life. He was often in a kind of a dream state. Mm-hmm. And so I was unsure that he was even really registering us. You know what I mean? Because he would talk about acid and, you know, like seeing the musical notes at a jazz performance. And, you know, he'd sort of go on these tangents. And I was like, he probably doesn't even know our names, you know? And so to have that kind of attention from him was, you know, I took very seriously.
Yeah.
And also, I didn't know what the fuck I was going to do, you know? I was like, I'm not going to go, the CIA is here looking for people. I'm not going to go there. You know?
See, that was your big mistake.
I love how the story reveals this part of you, though, that seems to be a core part that's different than the way you look at yourself. And that part is the person who brings the keyboard in and plays Twin Peaks, that part is the person, I mean, you just came, it's very Flannery O'Connor coded. Because she, when she was here, she just walked right up to the workshop to Paul Engel and she was like, I'm not a journalist, I want to be in the workshop. And he was like, yep, let's do this. Like, I love, when you describe yourself, I feel like you might be leaving out of that very important part, which is just this courageous hero that's bringing the keyboard in and playing the Twin Peaks song.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think about that courage, you know, to sort of apply for the Robert Stone's fiction writing course, even though I didn't have the prerequisites, and, you know, and later, you know, I pitched a book with very little preparation and got a book deal and did that. And this is perhaps unfair to my younger self, but I see it as somebody who wanted to skip steps, you know, where I was just like, yeah, I just want to get to the good stuff, you know, but
But sometimes that works.
Yeah, and I also think, I mean, not that you need reassurance, but I feel like it's such a common thing. Like, you even hear students sometimes say, like, well, you know, you're giving them all this information about craft, and the first thing they want to know is, like, well, when I get to Los Angeles, like, how do I get an agent? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like, at that age, I think, wants to get to the place that is fun and looks glamorous from their sort of vantage point, but they don't realize that it's such a long distance away, you know?
And I don't think you'd even do it if you weren't trying to skip step. I mean, think of ourselves when we first started writing. If we went back to ourselves now and said, guess what? This is how much work
it took. I had a lot of delusion and romanticism and idealism, but I think that's what, at a young age, like, allows you to go and to give it a try. I mean, you have to want to do it, but like, I think that's so forgivable. Like, I don't know. So
it's necessary. I think it's necessary.
Yeah.
So after Stone's class, you are a senior. And so then do you just immediately say, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life and I'm going to go get an MFA? And
no, not immediately. No, I had, when I was a senior in college, I had gotten an assignment to write an article for Playboy about the anti-globalization movement. Talk about fucking split personality.
Wait, are you a Gemini?
No, I'm a Scorpio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I have lots of questions about how this assignment came to. But anyway, let's continue. So you have the assignment from Playboy.
Let me just skip to the postscript, which is when the article came out. My stepbrother called me. He's like, so how can I get a copy of your article? And I was like, just fucking go to the newsstand and say, my sister's in Playboy. I need a copy.
My sister's in Playboy.
Yeah.
So I reported this article. And I thought, okay, well, maybe I should be a journalist, you know. But I was very journalism. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to. I knew how to, like, have the chutzpah to show up, but I didn't know how to listen and ask questions, and because I was too self-conscious, you know. And I moved to New York after college, and I was living with a few students from college, and we were living a block away from the World Trade Center in 2001. And so apartment was in the frozen zone. And, you know, kind of whatever, our lives kind of fell apart. And so I was scared and jobless and homeless and was like, I'd better go back to school. That's why I went back to school, is because I was like, the world's too much for me. And I applied to journalism programs and to MFA programs in fiction writing, and I didn't know which one was right for me, you know. I mean, I had had these two bits of confirmation, you know, that I'd published this article. Wasn't very good, but it was a feature, and I'd had this piece of advice from Robert Stone, and so I applied to both, and I was rejected by the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, where my sister was a student. She was a poet in this program. Yeah.
What?
We're so sorry.
Their loss. Yeah.
No, it was the right decision. I can't believe I got into Virginia. I mean, I was just not.
I mean, you had
ready.
Amazing teachers there, it sounds like.
I did. Yeah, I did. I worked with Deborah Eisenberg, who is just my favorite fiction writer of all time.
Also one of Steven's teachers.
Yeah.
And
we talked about that.
Ann Beattie. Yeah. And I don't know if I ever told her that Robert Stone had assigned me the bowl. So I ended up going to Virginia. I spent 2 years there and learned how to write sentences, and, you know, it was great.
So I'm sort of curious about, like, at this point, you're writing fiction, maybe you're in a fiction workshop. Did you still feel like, was it still a big thrill for you to have people read your work and be excited about it? Because it seems like there's, like, a performative part of you that enjoys the performance or the sort of delivery and then the reception and that sort of feedback of enthusiasm from like an audience. So
yeah.
So was that there for you in graduate school, or was it missing, or kind of how was your write? Did you enjoy writing then, or you know what was it
I
like?
I did, but like I mean, I guess there are two primary things I think of when I think of the way I was writing at that time and what I was writing about. The first thing I think of is that instead of going to graduate school, I should have gone to therapy. Because I was really dealing with like a lot of trauma from like, you know, my dad's death. And we then got a blended family that had a lot of, you know, a lot of dysfunction. We now all love each other, but it was very hard. You know, and then I had 9/11. Just I had a lot of shit that was kind of that I was processing. And I was doing that through short stories that I was writing for class. Hmm. And what they really were confessions, you know. They were really my need to put my experience on paper was superseding my need to write a good story. So that's one thing, I think. And then the other thing, I think, is I was only really interested in feedback if people seemed to enjoy what I was doing.
Wow.
You know, I just couldn't really, like, on you know, when I would turn in stories that didn't hit, I'm like, I don't even want to be here. We shouldn't even have class today because I'm just going to leave this alone. I only want to be here if I can feel like I've entertained you. So that's what, I mean, I was 22. I was little. And so that's, and I got a lot of support, you know. I mean, I had a great class. I had really great mentors. And then I remember Richard Bausch came through and as a visiting writer. And he met with me and read my work. And he was like, I think you should move to Oklahoma and work in a motel.
Sage advice.
Oh, and I was like, bro, I have got like 6 years of higher education. I can't.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't.
Well, at least you knew. You were like, no, you're not going to Robert Stone me, dude.
Well, let's time travel a little bit here at the end. And if you could go back to that version of yourself writing that story on the grid paper, mm-hmm. trying to entertain your friends, working through all that stuff, what do you think, Juan, what would you like say to that person and what do you think she'd think of about where you are now?
Well, I can answer the second question first because it's easy. I think that she would be fucking amazed. Yes. I mean, it would be like, you got into the TV?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I didn't know that there was a road inside of that. You know, yeah, I think she would be amazed. And I guess I would say, you know, it sort of goes beyond what's on the page, but like have some compassion for yourself. Yeah. You know, I think I was trying so hard to please people and make them like me by entertaining them, you know. Yeah.
And as you talk about getting into the TV, before we head out, I think it would be really interesting for our listeners to just sort of hear about how you went from the MFA.
Yeah, for sure.
I know that you wrote a book that I really loved, but I know you might have some different thoughts. That's a nonfiction book. That's a lot of immersive journalism. It's really, I thought, fascinating. But how did you make the leap from sort of fiction, narrative nonfiction into television? And I mean, again, when you talk about what you read, in that sort of serialized performative piece that you were doing in eighth grade, to even the work you were doing in grad school where you were saying, I just wanted to feel like I was entertaining people. That's a lot of what's happening in television. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting to me to see that arc brought you back there. But I'd just love to hear, and I'm sure our audience would love to hear, sort of how you made that jump from writing short stories into getting into the television.
Yeah. I mean, I sold my book, you know, at the time, I don't know if this is still true, but you could sell a nonfiction book on a proposal and a sample mm-hmm. chapter. And I didn't feel I had the fortitude to write something that maybe was going to sell and maybe not. So I didn't have the fortitude to write a novel. And I sold this book. It went undercover in Jerry Falwell's church for 2 years.
CIA.
Which was,
there it is.
Was CIA.
Yeah.
And I had a miserable experience writing it. And I was alone just alone all the time, eating like out of a cereal box, just dry cereal, you know, all day long. And there was just no escape from it, you know, and I just felt like it. I could never quite get my – I mean, here's the thing is I went into it bare-assed. I didn't really have a plan for it. And one of the editors who turned me down said, whenever we've bought a nonfiction book where there's not a thesis or a plan for it, it doesn't work. And I was like, except for now, you know. But I didn't – I don't think I knew what the book should have been until after it was published.
You wanted to skip some steps.
I wanted to skip some steps, So I wrote that and I was like, I'm never doing this again. It's horrible. It's a horrible experience.
So I'm curious. So presumably then you sort of made your way west sort of into television. When I'm curious about, first of all, when you did learn and how you learned to be able to take criticism, take notes, because you must have reached a point when you started to work in Hollywood where people were giving you notes. And you sort of got to the point where you could take the notes without feeling like, oh, no, I don't want to be in the room. So how did that happen? Did you – like that seems like it would be a transformation. Did you feel like you just kind of got – you were able to do that because you knew it was required? Or was it a different experience to take notes in Hollywood from people than it was to get criticism in workshop or – you know?
I think by the time I got to Hollywood, I had – developed some humility because I was not proud of my book because I felt like I actually don't know how to write, you know, and I was really desperate to learn. So I think that's that it was that circuit of failures, you know, or anyway, my circuit of perceived failures that I felt like all around me, my peers were getting their lives together. And I was, you know, adjuncting and waiting tables and not able to write. And, you know, it was just really – so I came with, like, I'll do anything, you know, to learn how you guys do it.
And I know that you worked with David Milch.
I did, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's amazing. What would you say would be, like, the biggest thing you learned from working with Milch?
I mean, I worked for him for about 2 years – talking about character all day long, for months.
That's great. I was just going to ask you when you started to become less interested in the confessional and more interested in character. So sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, before anything could be written, you would just do weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks with, you know, in fascinating conversations that reminded me a lot of being in school, you know, just going deep on a person's psyche and, you know, and that is the predicate for being able to put anything on the page.
That reminds me of Brett, where he was doing interviews with his characters.
Brett Anthony Johnson.
Yeah, outside of the book. And then I feel like his editor, his agent was like, let's put these in the book. Like he never intended the interviews with his characters. And then they became like the book's podcast or whatever. So, I mean, I love that idea of getting to know them. The characters.
That's awesome. So, Gina, one question before we head out. I always love to know, and I think our audience is always interested in, what are you working on now? We know from The Big Binge and folks who are listening, you should all stream and watch on Hulu, Clipped. It's so good. And that came out last spring. What are you working on now? Are you doing
more? Are you allowed
more
to tell us?
Oh, yeah. Also, are you allowed to tell us?
I think so. I am developing two shows for FX. One is about a very wholesome personal injury lawyer, family law firm in Charlotte, North Carolina. And, you know, it's about a guy who, I mean, this is sort of on the theme of hypocrisy. It's about a guy who feels desperate to prove that, you know, he's working on the side of the little guy, you know, in spite of the terrible reputation of personal injury lawyers as ambulance chasers and you know, materialistic shakedown artists.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I'm working on is I'm working with a writer-director named Hannah Fidel. And with David Chase on a project for FX that's about, I think I can say this, about a madam who goes into witness protection.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Whoa. Yeah.
Gina, it's been an absolute pleasure having you, not just on this podcast, but here in Iowa City. We often talk to folks who come through about their experiences in town. It just so happens that many of our guests have spent time here. And we like to always say to them, like, welcome home. I hope that you know that Iowa City is now a home for you, too. You're welcome back anytime.
Air horn, air horn.
Just thank you so much for everything you did for
I love
our,
it here,
for our students.
This has just been such a treat.
Thank you, Gina, so much.
And thanks for joining us on this podcast.
Support for this podcast comes from the University of Iowa, the Magid Center for Writing, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Graduate College. We'd like to thank the Center for Language and Culture Learning for use of their podcast studio. Sad Me of the Past is part of the Writing University Podcast Network at the University of Iowa. This network includes podcasts from creative writing programs and departments all across our campus. Visit writinguniversity.org/podcasts to see our full list of offerings, including Writing Matters, The 11th Hour, Origins, The Short Coat, and more.
Remember, everybody. She can cut those out. Remember, sorry, Steven.